CliffCentral.com.
Alrighty, there we go. We eventually got it right. The Gareth Cliff Show, CliffCentral.com. Tuesday morning. You'd think we'd know how to do this by now, you know? You'd think we'd be like old hands at it. Ah, excellent, excellent. Good morning. Alright, so lots of things to get into this morning. We're going to be joined by Mpumile Dwaba just now. She is a founder of Wisdom and Wellness Anino Beauty. She's also a YouTuber with over 15 million views on YouTube. And these people are interesting to me, so I've decided that we need to do a little deep dive into the world of YouTube and find out who they are and why they are so successful. And who knows, you might be, it might spark some kind of idea in you. And next thing you know, you're a famous YouTuber. So this is all within the realms of possibility. You don't have to be some kind of genius. You also don't have to be the most innovative person in the whole world. But you do have to have something, and I want to know what that is. So we'll be speaking to Pumi a little bit later on. We've also got JJ Cornish joining us today. And we will be joined by Douglas Rattray, who's someone I've wanted to talk to for a long, long time. Douglas, of course, part of that terrific family that have done so much to tell the story, the history of KZN. You know, and the Zulu history of that part of the world, the story of the battles of Tetshwayo, the British Empire, the Boers. This is the stuff that we hear about in maybe one or two lessons in history class, and that's about it. But there is such a rich, rich story to be told. And this family have done the most extraordinary job of doing that. Only problem is that Douglas's dad, David, was murdered on his farm years ago. And it was a great loss to everybody. Of course, the good part of this, if there is something good to come out of something so horrible, is that Douglas took over from his dad and is doing a sterling job of keeping those stories alive. And, you know, we've had some pretty amazing people on the show over the years. And some of them have told the story from the side of Tetshwayo. Some of them have told the story from the side of, you know, the Battle of Rorke's Drift and the British who were stuck behind a couple of low walls. And then there are those people who've told the story from the point of view of like Andries Pretorius at Blood River. But always it's the most fascinating thing to me. And as someone who, as you know, loves history, it's just great to be able to check in with someone like David. I mean, with Douglas and with his family and, you know, the stories that they've helped to put back front and center in our national story. And Bulelo is here with us this morning too. We're also going to have Mpumi join us just shortly. But we want to know what you're thinking and what you're up to today. Obviously, yesterday there wasn't this extraordinary outbreak of violence everybody was expecting on the Jacob Zuma or the unrest side of things, which is a relief. There were lots and lots of people who were, I think, secretly hoping for it. Some people just want to watch the world burn. those people were, oh yay, more nastiness. It's the same people who go, oh yay, Corona's 17th wave, yay, this is exciting. Now you
and you know there's a, yeah, you know there's a Susie who her full time job is being on holiday, mm-hmm. and she was just hoping this would happen because her husband would pay for that Mauritius break, you know, because she needs a break from the break she just came back from in the Maldives.
I know someone.
If there's crime, I gotta go.
I know someone like that. I know someone who needs. She's convinced that holidays are the only way for her to be a happy and successful person. And if she doesn't have enough of them, and by enough I mean 10 times the amount that you or I would consider reasonable, then she starts having little tantrums. Anyway, besides the point. So Mbolelo, you've got this interesting point of view about how summer is going to be the this is going to be the kind of final grand royale battle in South Africa between us and the government who just keeps extending this lockdown nonsense. And we're not going to talk about Corona or lockdowns all morning, I promise. But this is interesting because summer's coming. People are feeling good. I was outside a lot of yesterday. It was such a beautiful day. I was wearing a, you know, like a t-shirt and wandering around. So what's your feeling on this?
So here's what I'm thinking, right, is that I'm fully aware about my fellow South Africans that we are not the type of people, we're not Australians, we're not these Brits, is like we are very much, we did this, so you will do this. You know, there is no government forever, forever. It's like, we were really good last Christmas. You'd better believe people are breaking out this year. This year, there is just going to be so much mouth-to-mouth action, saliva swapping, and just, it is going to be electric. And if the government thinks any rules that they've put in place, because we've been, by South African standards, let's be fair, I'd like to think
we've been reasonably well behaved,
incredibly well behaved.
I mean, by South African standards, yeah, sure, we've had some riots and we've had some second and third waves that we've spread to the rest of the world, but we've been mostly well behaved. I agree.
No, those are mitigating circumstances. Like I said, we're South Africans. So the looting is what we call collateral damage in war. But I'm just thinking, because I'm kind of seeing the mood of some of the language and the rhetoric coming from government, because I can see what they're gearing up for, because they know that the savannas are going to be on the head from the 1st of September. There is nothing they are doing to stop that. And they're already trying to squeeze us with the language. Forget it.
Oh, really? You don't think there's a part of us that just complies, because we are, most people in this country are very well behaved. They follow the rules. They do all of that stuff. You don't think there's going to be a part of us that just complies like the New Zealanders or Australians?
Maybe us nerds and the verbs. I'm talking more widespread South Africa. Forget it.
Well, more widespread South Africa's never given a shit about this stuff.
But relatively speaking, is people have said, and my family largely lives in townships and in the homelands. Everybody has been concerned, and I'm just using my family, might be anecdotal. But now, the one family group with my cousins in the Eastern Cape, boy, oh boy.
They don't give a shit, huh?
They've already purchased booze just in case. So they've already got booze, because my cousins are thinking Cyril and his guys are going to try and do round two. They are so ready for the 1st of September. And no, there's no way, Gareth. There's no way. Right. South Africans, there's no way. Well, and shout out to us, South Africa.
Well,
you lied to us.
And they've lied to us. They've lied to us a few times. But let's use this as the opportunity to bring in Phumile Dwaba. She's a famous YouTuber. She's got incredible success on that channel. She's also the founder of Wisdom and Wellness, Anino Beauty. And what a pleasure to have you on, Phumi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys doing this morning?
Good. Bulelo, can you just boost her levels a little bit on your side? And even yours a little bit. I've got her on full. It's cool. Nice to see you. And you look fantastic for this time in the morning.
No, guys, like, how do you do this? Like, I've still got my morning voice, and you guys are fresh, like, full blast, chatting, and I'm just like, I just need my normal voice to come back. Like,
listen, we do this every day, so don't be impressed, I promise. It's, we don't even think about it now. But for you to join us is very, very nice this morning, and thank you for being a part of the show. Hey, congrats on all the success that you're having online. It's really impressive. And, I was saying at the start of the show, I'm on a mission to meet and to understand some of the most incredible successes that South Africans are having on YouTube, because this is something that, like 5-10 years ago, nobody would have said this was possible, because everybody said, oh, without the infrastructure or the backbone or investment or any of that stuff, people just couldn't do this. Look at the success you're having, for heaven's sake. Like, 198,000 subscribers, 15 million views. You're a podcaster. You're a speaker. You've got your own beauty company. Could you have predicted all of this? Would you have said this was possible?
Actually not. Firstly, I didn't even watch YouTube. listen, I still really do. Like, I've got very selected things. So I'm not one of those people who's always like watching TV or watching what's next, but my husband is. And he randomly came to me and said, hey, I think you should start a YouTube channel. I'm like, me? Why? I've got nothing to say. And he's like, no, you've got a whole lot to say. Let's just start and we'll figure out the rest. Mm-hmm. And literally, that's what I did. I had no microphone. I had literally no equipment when I started out. So I used boxes as my tripod. And then I would wait for the sun so that I could have good lighting. And then I'd use a cell phone. And amazing. I did my first video. People related, because I was actually just telling my truth. And I think, going back to the success, could I have predicted what we learned on the way of creating my YouTube channel, is that I have to be authentic. I have to be relatable. And that's what people gravitate towards. And also, I think outside of that, you start studying the trends. What's a good time to upload? What are people actually interested in? What's a good slot? Like, do you do 30-minute video, 10-minute video?
Right.
Things like that. You start studying. But I think the most important is being authentic and true and tell stories people actually relate to.
Well, well done. I mean, nobody starts at exactly the right time, and nobody has all the right equipment, and nobody has everything in place, and nobody even really knows exactly. I don't think there's a single person who started a successful job, business, idea, entertainment show, whatever it might be. There's not a single person who's done that with everything in place, and they've thought of all the outcomes, and they've planned for every eventuality. You sometimes just have to do it and then figure it out along the way, right?
Absolutely. I even have a video on YouTube called What's in Your Hands. Basically, just start, because we all want to kind of have it figured out. We want to have the business. I mean, I have a beauty business, and I don't even have a business plan, and I've been going for 4 years.
Amazing.
So we've got this thing where we need to have the business plan. We need to have the right chair, all the right stuff, and that's the one thing that will actually keep us from starting anything. But we just have to look at what we have and just start. And that's why I think that's one of the good things about COVID. I heard you guys talking about South Africa. That's one of the good things that people realized, hey, guys, we actually have to make our own plans. And people started YouTube channels. People are gravitating towards podcasts. I'm sure when you started, there was like 3 people tuning in.
Oh, my God.
Even when I started, I had to explain to people what a podcast is.
Yeah.
And in America, it's been happening for like 10 years, and we're just jumping on. But I guess that's one of the good things about COVID, is that people said, hey, there's actually another world online.
You know, Pumi, I was just listening to you talking about your business. And by the way, what kind of beauty stuff do you guys do? What products do you make? What kind of stuff do you do?
So we are a salon. We do hair. As you can see, my hair is all cute and stuff.
Very
and
nice.
We do nails. We do brows. We do waxing. Basically, it's a whole beauty
parlor. Where are you
parlor.
Based?
And yes, we do. Pardon?
Where are you based?
We in Dunkeld.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah, so, we're in Dunkeld.
Very nice.
So there
very
you go.
Nice. Right? So bougie.
All the ladies are out.
There we go. Listen. You're talking about bougie. Mbulela's your number one bougie northern suburb.
I heard. Yeah. I'm like, where does this accent come from?
I tell you what, I know a few people in Dunkeld that just cannot wait to get to Pony's place. She's unbelievable. Do you know what? I don't have too many black friends, but she
is
unbelievable. This Pony is, and her husband, let me tell you,
what a nice guy.
To die for.
All right, so
Garrett,
yeah.
I actually want to tell you, I was saving the story because I work with my husband, Brendan, and before I accepted the show, I was like, do you think I should do this? Because we always consult each other. He's like, I love Garrett. Actually, Garrett is the only person that spoke to me after I got second place in Idols.
Wow, is that your husband?
Yeah, Brendan Praise, yes.
That's amazing. Wow,
I
didn't know that
small
until
world,
this morning.
Right?
It is a small world. You know, that show that show is like a good ghost that follows me around, because I sometimes meet people and they'll say, don't you remember me? And I go, no. Happened to me just last week. I'm like, no. And she goes, but I was in the top 49 of, you know, season 6. And I go, really? I don't even remember some of the winners. So, I mean, no, I remember your husband.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, tell him I say hello.
Yeah. Well, he's downstairs with the kids. But the reason I mentioned that is it's crazy how people will never forget how you made them feel, especially at like their lowest. Like, I think that moment for him was such a low moment, and he just needed one person to say, hey, I see you, and you did exactly that. And for that reason, he will never ever forget that. That's the one thing he remembers about the night.
Well, I mean that makes me feel really good about it, because sometimes I think about it was a fun project, and you know, maybe I did it for 1-2 years too long. And but then you hear a story like that, and you're like, nope, there's a reason for these things.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for telling me. And I'm not very good at first of all taking compliments, and second of all hearing nice things said about myself. I don't know why. Maybe because I say so many things that are ridiculous or outrageous or just stuff that people disagree with, you know. And I'm so used to being on the defensive. I'm like, oh, someone's going to say this is terrible. Yeah. Someone's going to say you're a bad person. So you're kind of on your defenses.
I think it's a genius thing to do. I think Kanye West's mom said it when they were having an interview, when they were talking together. And she said something about that, now I forgot the phrase and I don't want to get it wrong. But essentially what she was trying to say is that a genius never really sees themselves. And it's hard for someone who's doing extremely well and who excels and who takes their work really seriously to receive compliments, because they're always thinking, oh, but I could be better at this. Yeah. I could do this. So I think that's why people who are really doing well find it hard to take compliments.
I suppose you also, I'm used to a lot of criticism, and it normally doesn't bother me because I'm used to so much of it. So if you're on that side of the spectrum where you're constantly expecting bad feedback, or at least constructive criticism some of the time, but destructive criticism a lot of the time, what happens is that when things go to the opposite side of the spectrum, it catches you unawares. So you're almost uncomfortable about it. That's really the only way I can explain it. But I wanted to go back to something you said now about business. And, you know, starting a business and doing what you're doing, whether it's on YouTube or your actual salon, people have this weird idea, and I think it comes from the fact that theory and practice are so different to each other. Like, if you go to business school, or you study an MBA, or you have read a couple of entrepreneurial books or whatever, you see it all in theory, right? And someone explains to you, you need a business plan, you need to know how to operate cash flow, you need to know about hiring staff, and people try to upskill themselves with all of that stuff, which is in theory very good. And of course, you can't ignore that stuff. I'm not saying it's dumb and pointless and stupid, but there's such an emphasis on that stuff. And Bolo, you'll know about this too. I mean, you've started and been involved in a number of projects. The real test of all of that isn't how much you know from those books or from those classes or from the theory or from the professor or from the idol that you have in business. That stuff is maybe 10-20% of the whole story, because practically that's where you learn. Like, practically you've got a month. Yeah. You've got a month where there's just no money, you know. There's that one month where, oh my God, how the hell am I going to pay my people? There's that one month where you go, we have no stock. There's just nothing to sell. Mm. People don't believe in me this month. They've got bored. They're dropping off instead of going up. And you have to make plans on the trot. And sometimes that stuff, and it's not glamorous, hey, that's not the stuff people, you can't explain that because it's so individual and it's so particular to everyone's unique experience of business, that all that business plan shit goes right out of the window. You're like, oh my God, this month I'm just going to have to sell muffins. The business is not going to make it unless I sell muffins. And then you sell muffins for that month, and you never sell muffins again, and you wouldn't tell anybody about the muffin story because to you it was just like survival. It's not very exciting or interesting. And then looking back, you're like, if I hadn't sold those muffins, I would have been in big, big shit. Am I right?
Absolutely. I mean, I did BCom accounting, which means I actually had business as a module. I dropped out, by the way, after like 2.5 years.
Don't worry, me too.
And then you're so right about the stories, because I remember like my first big test of business where I thought, surely, like, I made the biggest mistake of my life. I just go back to school, just go get a job.
Get a
job. When I was about 8 months pregnant, all my staff quit. Everybody.
All of them.
I was just left. Everyone. Jeez. I was just left
with
my.
Do they hate babies, or what's the story? Why do they?
No, it's just how the beauty industry works. It's got a very high staff turnover, and it's just known. You know it in theory, but when it happens to you, it's just like, oh, me? Why would you leave me? I've been good to you, you know.
Right.
And all my staff left, and at 8 months pregnant, while acetone is like a what we use to soak off nails, was smelling so bad, I had to sit down and go back to doing nails. And to touch on that, it's so important that as a business owner, you know exactly what's happening in every aspect and department of your business. I use the word department very carefully because it's not like we've got an office block where there's that department here and that department here. But anyway, so that was one of the first big tests where you've got now clients, but you've got no staff. And you can't just pick up people and say, hey, guys, come work for me, because they need the skill. And just because you went to nail school or beauty school doesn't mean you're good. And your clients are used to a certain standard. And then we have to speak about COVID-19, because we're a business that only makes money if we're providing a service.
And
right?
People are actually there because they can't do their own hair at home and you charge them.
No.
Especially in Dunkel. That they can't do anything at home without somebody being there to do it for them. So
listen. And so when the first hard lockdown took place, it was just like, and our people get paid via commission. We have to now make plans. Do I pay people because that's out of the goodness of my heart, or do I just say, hey guys, listen, we'll see you when the business opens? And those are some of the decisions you make. And we took a decision to say, let's pay people. We'll pay people out of our pockets. And we did that. And then when we opened, a few months down the line, all the staff quit again and went to go start their own business.
You must be a horrible
Three
boss.
People. No, I'm actually a really good boss. No,
or your baby's horrible. Maybe your baby's horrible. You thought about that.
No!
I'm going to blame you. I'm blaming you.
This happens. I've had these people for about three years, the longest. And all three of them went and started their own business. So they're like a dream team now, started their own thing. And they tried to take my clients. And because I'm a good boss, my clients called me and be like, hey, just wanted to let you know that they tried to poach me. You understand?
Yeah.
So
this happened to someone. This happened to someone I know recently, and she was in tears. She's like, "Oh, my clients are being stolen by a former employee." That happens.
And it really does happen.
But you know, people burn bridges, and they don't realize.
Yeah.
They don't realize how.
Yeah.
Short term, they think they're making a victory, but long term, you're. So I just
don't think you can start anything with people's tears. Like, you can't start anything with
that's
the foundation.
A good line. I like that.
Yeah.
Don't start things with people's tears. So Zuzile says, hey, Mommy Mpumi, I wonder why you called Mommy. I follow your great work with Brendan. All the best in your new home. Oh, nice. Did you just move into a new home?
We did. We just bought a new house with some great square meters.
Maybe your staff saw that online. Maybe your staff saw that online and they thought, oh, I'm stuck in my small house in lockdown. How the hell is she buying a new house? Mm. I'm getting out of here. Plus, her baby's terrible. I'm also getting out of here.
Oh,
I'm not saying
goodness.
Your baby is terrible. Maybe your staff hated
you. You've been saying, I just need to fight for my babies now because I've got two babies.
Yeah.
My babies are amazing.
Right.
All right.
But we did just buy a new home. And she was asking why they call me Mommy.
Yeah.
When I was on my YouTube channel, it was a random thing, actually. I was pregnant and I was telling people a story. And then I was just like, y'all can call me Mrs. Mom. And then people started calling me Mrs. Mom.
Nice.
Literally.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, listen.
Yeah.
I love seeing success. And there are a couple of people here like, oh, no, YouTubers, what do they have to add? Listen,
grilled eyes.
That's I mean, you don't have to follow Mpumi if you don't like her, but I think you're missing out. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on was to talk about YouTube and all that stuff, which we'll get to. But also just to get to know you, you know. I mean, there are so many people who are making it, and here I think Michael makes an excellent point. The magnificence of the internet and crypto is that there's a whole generation who are creating wealth without having to pander to the aged adults that we still keep voting for and other people. You know, even the old established business people, like, you didn't need any of them. You didn't need any handouts. You didn't need anybody to know somebody in a municipality to give you the work. And I love examples like yours because it just shows a whole lot of people that in the end, the best people will find a way. And you've just got to make it happen. I mean, you can't just abandon your responsibilities as a kid. You want success. You want to do things. And you've made it happen, even in lockdown. Congratulations. I love it.
Thank you. I think even in the influencer industry, the online industry, I made the most money I've ever made during lockdown.
Awesome.
So
awesome.
If if people don't believe in it, I'm not trying to. We just bought a new house.
Mm-hmm. What are you
doing? In the middle of the pandemic.
Tell them.
In the middle of the pandemic. And it's not to brag or anything, but I'm just saying, like, if people don't believe in, we've got nothing to prove. Well, our coins are settled. Our bank accounts are just like,
beautiful.
We're good over there. And you know what? We just continue to reinvent ourselves. We don't know what's next. And that's why I jumped onto podcasts. Cause at the end of the day, you don't want to be stuck in something, but you always need to be in front. And what's happening? How can I reinvent myself? How can I get better? Mm-hmm. For example, podcast has helped me become a better speaker. So even in my speaking engagements, I realized, oh, actually, I'm getting better at the speaking thing. Because all you have to do for like a good 30 minutes on podcast is have something interesting to say.
Well, that's it. And sometimes your guests do a lot of the work for you. But on those days where they don't, you have to make sure you've got something interesting to bring in. Otherwise, people are just going to go, you know, what am I listening to this shit for? Because it's not improving my life. It's not making me feel better. Mm. Well, okay, let's get into some headlines for this morning. There's quite a lot of news, and I think it's important for us to just pay attention to what's going on, make sure that we're not left out in the cold with nothing to talk about or with no knowledge of what's happening. So prisoners are apparently being drafted in. I don't know about if this would ever work in South Africa, but this seems to be working in the UK. So prisoners have been brought in to plug the worker shortage in the meat industry. This is really interesting. Meat industry leaders held talks with the government on Monday to discuss options of how business could link up with prisons to fill vacancies. Now, that's great for the meat industry in the UK, but what I want to know and what I'd like to ask you guys this morning is, do you think that our prisoners in this country would be helpful or good at anything? And if so, like, we've got a lot of things that need fixing in this country, right? And maybe there are a couple of prisoners who are skilled. I don't know. They could be, and they might be really good at certain things. What could our prisoners do, apart from the obvious filling potholes? And I think they should be out there working. First of all, it's good for them to have something to do rather than just sitting around looking for trouble, smoking, you know, taking drugs, whatever they're doing. I think it would be good for them to get out and do some work. Work is a way for people to feel purposeful. And at the same time, we are paying for them to have board and lodging anyway. So let's be as cold as we can about this. Prisoners don't really add value to society. What we have to do is pay for them to eat and to sleep and to, you know, hopefully to rehabilitate. But in some cases, that doesn't happen. What can we make them do in this country that would put them to use and make them feel useful? Any ideas?
I've never really thought about it. But I've never really thought of, like, our prisoners as different from British prisoners. Like, if you're in prison, 98% of the time, you're a shithead, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think, oh, they're in the UK, oh, very nice.
I mean, obviously, there are those people who are wrongfully accused, and that happens. You know, we've got a shitty justice system. Sure, we've got a shitty justice system here, and there are a lot of people who are in awaiting trial prisons, for example, that have done nothing wrong, and they just can't afford legal counsel and all that stuff. But let's just say we took our prison population, which is not small, and we made them clean the government buildings or pick up litter in the CBDs or something really good to just improve the morale of the overall country and just make us think, there are people fixing things. There are people making things better. There are people tidying up the place. Don't you think that would be good?
What about construction, maybe forming part of the people who are building the many houses that are supposed to be given to poor people? Because, I kind of believe in making them work, because it's not rehab if people are just surrounded by a bad company and they're chilling and they do nothing.
Absolutely.
But I think everyone needs a sense of purpose. And I think that's a good way to help someone get out of their own world. Because, I mean, to be in prison, most cases, chances are you're a very selfish human being who only thinks about themselves, right? So I'd like to think if there's a bigger purpose attached to them, like, oh, you guys are you're building houses for the old age.
Right.
This is what you're doing. This is who it's going to help. I think that human being inside of them could come alive. So I think it's actually quite a good idea. Hopefully, like, measures will be taken, because, you know, people are arrested for, like, different things. But I think it's a good idea. They should work. And also it makes it easier when they come out. Because the reason why people keep going in and out of jail is because when they come out, it's like, well, nobody sees me. I'm not a citizen here. I've got nowhere to go, nothing to do. Nobody wants to hang out with me. I don't have a job. So, heck, let's just go back in there. It was better in there. But I think if the sense of purpose begins while they're still in prison, then it's like a good start.
Love that. And I do think it's teaching them skills, right?
Yeah, teaching skills, yeah.
And you said the meat industry, what you're hoping is there's no necrophiliacs there that once they smell that dead rotten meat, that you're not eliciting something, you know?
Oh, that's horrible.
Okay, terrible. Well, you're dealing with prisoners. This is no time that's to get a queasy stomach.
Well, apparently Ethiopia, and this is something we can maybe discuss with Jean-Jacques Cornish just now in African Analysis, but Ethiopia have decided enough with this Facebook and Twitter and WhatsApp. They're going to build their own versions of these things. They've decided they're going to develop their own social media platforms to rival Facebook, Twitter, and WhatsApp, although they don't plan to block the global services that we've just mentioned. Ethiopia has been engulfed since last year in an armed conflict that's pitted the federal government against the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which controls the region in the country's north. Supporters of both sides have waged a parallel war of words on social media. Now, the government says it wants a local platform to replace Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, and Zoom. That's what the Director General of the Information Network Security Agency, that sounds like a really great organization, huh? The Information Network Security Agency. I love the way they use words that sound like they should be good, but we know it's just autocracy in another form.
You know, Ethiopians are, like, I like Ethiopia, but they are maybe the biggest douchebags in Africa, right? And I know but we have to ever say that they like the Swiss people in Africa, in the sense that once they're Ethiopian, they think they've invented the world. They can't wait to tell you about their lineage and what they're going to do.
Is that is that your experience of Ethiopians?
Yes.
No,
I've been to Ethiopia multiple times. Like, I've experienced, like, is this what you think of yourself? Like, yeah. No. This is not what's happening.
You stood on a landmine now for me. Okay, well, one more headline this morning. I don't know if that's going to work for Ethiopia, but there's this controversial state pension plan. A new report has shown how government ignored everyone's concerns. Surprise, surprise. I'm not going to go into too much detail here, but largely this is the work of the great Lindiwe Zulu and the Department of Social Development. They've got a green paper on comprehensive social security and retirement reform, which ignored a whole lot of things that people brought up when they have been looking at proposals. The government just decided, all that stuff that you brought up is not important because what do you know? It's your money. We get to decide, but it's not your decision, even though it's your money. This is your money you've saved for retirement, but we'll decide what to do with it. So they've just completely ignored people, and there's been no feedback. The former minister...
But don't they do that with everything?
Yeah, of course. Precisely. The former minister, Batabile Dlamini, submitted the paper to a NEDLAC task team back in 2016, and they came back with a huge list of suggestions, highlights of areas that needed more work. But the green paper, which they threw into the Government Gazette last week, just reproduced the text and recommendations of the 2012 paper. So they have not paid any attention. They just lip service. This is what government do. So don't worry.
Do you guys think you would do better if you were in government? Because I did an event, and it was a government event, and I've done private events, right? Mm-hmm. And I've seen the treatment and how the order runs in private events, and then the government event. And I said, to my mom, oh my goodness, I actually wish I just could have a year to just come and change things. And my mom, because my mom's in government, and she was just like, well, then you just become the target, because if you're there to change things and be Miss Goody Two Shoes, you're the target. So it's one of those places where you just kind of sink. Do you think that's true? Or do you think if we put you guys in power, you'd be able to actually say, you know what, I'm here to make the change?
I think we could, but I do agree with you that, like, there's a whole lot of anti-incentives built into government. Mm-hmm. Like, remember that they're not getting the best people, but they're paying a lot of money. So when you get people who are mostly, and I'm not saying this is true for all government, we've always said on this show, if you go back and listen to any episode of it, that there are a couple of people who really do know what's going on, but they keep their heads down. Because if they attract too much attention, then they make themselves a target, which is kind of what you're saying now. The scary thing for me is we need competence really badly. And I think even someone of average competence in the private sector could go into government and make a huge difference if they were empowered to do so. Many people have good ideas in government, but they're too afraid to take a chance because it could cost them their job. And it might be the only job that they've had. You know, so I don't know, but I don't think I could sit there and take that for long. I think it takes a certain kind of, I hate to say it, but almost like a slave mentality where you go into a job and you're like, oh, well, I'm just going to keep my head down, not cause any trouble, not try to improve things, let this thing run suboptimally, and maybe I'll be able to keep my job and just take some money out of the government. I don't know. I couldn't do
that. See, now that's the problem. I think that's the problem because now we're going to sit with a whole lot of incompetence because competent people are like, I'm just not willing to go to a place where I have to put my head down and I've got other things to do. And then people are like, you know what? I'll take the check. They'll be the ones who go in. And I guess it's just going to be an ongoing cycle
of people
saying, hey, let's just pull up 2012 stuff, reprint, and let's keep it moving.
Right. Bulelo, you want to add anything to that or should we scoot over to JJ Cornish?
What it is a sad reflection of what we've done in 25 years, because if you look at any country, and then there's a lot of great books on this, is anywhere where a Figile Mbalula is possible, where he's a celebrity, he's one of the big figures in the country, tells you that the people have put him into power. And it's impossible in Finland for politicians to become celebrities because largely the society is educated. So the natural environment is that, Ewen, I'm a mechanical engineer as a waiter here. There's no way. We're not going to allow that. The ecosystem just won't abide that. It will not abide it purely by the numbers at play. And it is a poor, poor reflection on what the government has done, but what we've allowed us as the citizen. Because you can't divorce yourself from as a citizenry from where your country is. Unfortunately, you don't get that option.
Yeah, so
we should be sad at ourselves.
I don't even care about their politics. I'm not even interested in what they think or what their ideology is. Just do the job. And, you know, like, I think that we just need people to do jobs. There's lots of stuff that needs doing in this place. Let's do it. Someone's going
to
pay for it.
I think it's care, man. Someone just needs to care. Like, just care. I feel like it has to care to a point where you think, you know what, if I don't close this pothole today, someone's going to lose a parent. I don't know. Maybe that should be we just need a perspective like that. Like, it's someone's life is at risk. It's not just a money thing. It's not just I don't feel like it today. It's someone's life.
But there are perverse incentives. It's like, If you fix that pothole, then the rest of the hyenas in your political party are going to say, ooh, he's trying very hard or she's trying very hard. Oh. We've got to watch them because they're a threat to me. You know, it's all me. So you're right. It's down to care. All right. Let's turn our attention to someone who really cares about the state of affairs of Africa. And it's something we pay as much attention as we can to on the show. Africanalysis is our bi-monthly feature brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School, and we look at what's going on the continent. This morning, we speak to none other than JJ Cornish. He is the expert when it comes to these kinds of things, and this morning, we're going to talk to him about some of the things that are going on in the country and in the continent. So, JJ, nice to see you. How are you?
Bonjour. I hope you're very well. I certainly am.
Excellent. I'm delighted to hear it. I'm very happy to hear it. That's good.
That's awesome.
Some people are embarrassed to admit.
I haven't even said anything funny yet and you're laughing. I don't know.
Well, you're saying I certainly am. Good for you. All right, so JJ, what's happening on the continent? We just mentioned Ethiopia, and I don't know if you heard any of that, and how they've decided that they need to launch their own Facebook and Twitter and WhatsApp because that'll help them contain this conflict that they're having with Tigray. What do you think of that?
The last time I had a regime that was not behaving well launched their own media, I was a much younger journalist, and it was the apartheid regime launching the citizen newspaper. You know, when regimes have to launch their own media, you know that that it's not going to be anything like a free or objective. Not that I believe in objectivity, I believe more in fairness. A media that's going to tell the story. I have to say, in South Africa at the moment, when I look at what has happened to newspapers, I'm absolutely at my wit's end because they're disappearing. So social media, with all its evils, I mean, I'm talking about fake news and that sort of thing, is in the ascendancy or in completely in command almost. Yeah. I can see the frustration of Ethiopians in wanting to try and counter that, but to create their own social media, well, does that mean Ethiopians are going to have to buy into it or are they going to be forced into it? I don't see that. You know, the old maxim with newspapers was that 55% of the surface area had to be covered by ads.
Yeah.
That meant that kept it going because the media is a business. Somebody's got to pay for it. And if it was less than that, then somebody else was picking up that tab, i.e. the government or someone. And, you know, they had much less credibility. And I fear that's what will happen in Ethiopia. And I see that Abiy Ahmed is not behaving impeccably. Is behaving more like a warmonger than a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. What is happening? Well, I'm the Tigrayans are no saints. They've got lots of money. They were formerly a very an ethnically superior group, smaller than others, but that held sway. And when their grip on power was released, they went into effectively war against the government. Mm-hmm. But right now we're having in Tigray the idea that they've got a propaganda war and they're running it from funds that they'd salted away to do that. And we're not getting the truth there from either side.
Mm-hmm.
I see that the Eritreans were involved. The United States has now slapped sanctions on the Eritrean military leader, Philos Wole Yohannes, for human rights abuses in Ethiopia, in Tigray. And they're saying that there's some chance that they might go back in. But I don't see that creating a social platform or creating media in any form by a government is helpful. You know, what you're getting what the Soviet Union did.
That's propaganda.
And, who believes them?
That's not social media. It's propaganda. And they'll obviously have their own rules that suit them. And I'm always very nervous when governments are the only people to be trusted in any situation. That's kind of why there's almost this built-in nervousness around even government trying to do the right thing, like let's say with COVID, because when government are the only source of truth in a society, you've got to be worried, even though in many cases they are trying to do the right thing. I mean, there's no reason government would want to kill its own people, for example, not on a massive genocidal scale, because otherwise they're going to lose out on the tax base, even if you're as cynical as that. There's something to be said for the fact that we live in a time now where these things are beyond government control. And I think it's good for Ethiopia in the long run and for Tigray, even if it leads to short-term violence, that the people there have a platform to express themselves. And it's going to be a tough job for a government anyway.
But they should have a platform. There are platforms.
Yes.
Why are they not? Are they using those? Are they using them to the displeasure of the government? You know, that's the factor. One of the ironies is that if you look at the latest newspaper figures, I read them assiduously every quarter.
Mm-hmm.
The Citizen is now almost is larger than the Star newspaper, and I mean that I never thought would be possible. So you know, I mean, once set up by the apartheid regime as a propaganda tool, the Citizen as a somewhat malcontent newspaper has prospered. The South Africans, certainly the South Africans who read it, I assume or presume that it's mainly Mlungus, like this message of violence and horror and what the government is doing. They're buying it.
It could just be that it's managed well. I mean, you know, sometimes a bad product that is managed well can sell and becomes more successful than a good product that is managed poorly.
Yeah.
That is the case, and in the newspaper trade, sadly, very much the case. Yeah, i.e., if you don't get your newspaper out to you know, the outlying areas, it just doesn't sell.
Yeah.
If the citizen is doing that better, then they're more bound to them. But
you know, frankly, I think the kind of people who do read The Citizen are probably quite old and still rely on newspapers, where many people have moved to the internet and don't get their news out of something which they mostly use to clean the windows. So, JJ, what do you make of the Zambian elections that have just happened? And we talked about other elections that have happened on the continent successfully. Some of them have been less free and fair than others. But we've had our own government say, oh, no, there's no way we can run our elections this year, even though they've been scheduled for this year and we're rapidly running out of year. Other countries have managed, despite COVID. What do you think this is, an excuse?
Well, you know, Hichilema, Hakainde Hichilema's victory is a source of some inspiration to opposition figures in across the continent in African politics. It's the sixth time he's contested the election, sixth time lucky, some people say. I don't think you can use the phrase lucky in politics. But there he was. He lost the previous election by 100,000 votes. And interestingly, previous president at first complained about the election in the way that, you know, that Donald Trump did, but then did concede. So it was an actual change of government, which is a very positive thing in Africa. You know, one thing to have a succession, a president taking over from another president in the same party, that is democratic, possibly. But real democracy is when one party replaces another, and that is what's happened in Zambia. And that is, of course, very good news for the continent. The proof of the pudding, of course, will be whether they can come out of their economic malaise. The first pandemic refusal or inability to pay its debt. And so it owes something like $12 billion to foreign banks, and you know, most of its 85% of its income goes into paying the interest on its debt. It's a very, very sad state of affairs in Zambia. Unemployment up, and you know, echoed and mirrored around the continent, even in our country. So he has his work cut out. Hichilema, a self-made billionaire who was a cattle herder, you know, raised cattle as a little boy. And grew up, got a scholarship, and then went off to study in Britain and got his advanced education. So he has promise, and we look with great anticipation and with great expectation to him.
Well, it sounds,
you know, the continent is at the moment, everybody's looking to what's happening in the only story that you ever get on television, which is Afghanistan, and seeing what on earth they can learn from them. And I have to say, all over the continent, there are some stark lessons, not the least in our neighboring Mozambique.
Yes.
What, you know, the reality that we're learning in Afghanistan, which, of course, the withdrawal, Donald Trump began it. Certainly Joe Biden could have reversed it, as he did other things Donald Trump did, but he continued it, and he's taking huge flak for it. The reality is, and we're seeing it in Mali with France, that the appetite, the political appetite for military intervention has waned completely.
Yeah.
And once that happens, then you do have politicians realize that their very existence is in threat if they keep sending boys and girls, soldiers, over to those countries and getting body bags back. They don't want that to happen anymore. Now, in Mozambique, we're getting European Union training Mozambican soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
The soldiers had better pick up on that training and take what they can, because the European Union's not going to be there forever.
No.
And we know that South African and SADC forces cannot be there forever. They just don't have the means to do it. So the Mozambicans, if they don't take advantage of this assistance, will find that integrists that have given them problems in Cabo Delgado are simply going to come back, as they did in the Taliban. I see the Somalis are absolutely delighted, saying that, you know, God is good, that Al-Shabaab has come back. You know, it comes back to one thing, and we say it all the time, it's become a cliche, that we cannot find military solutions to those kind of problems. We have to get political solutions, and those are hugely, hugely difficult. And there seems to be some idea that the Taliban is working along with the Americans, certainly in the evacuation. But now the possibility of that evacuation extending into next month, as
well,
members of the Taliban saying,
we've seen people dying already, and it's been absolute chaos in Kabul at the airport. And I think if this is someone's idea of a well-managed plan, then they don't know what well-managed means. It's just like the newspaper conversation we were having earlier. Sometimes a bad product can be managed well. Sometimes a good decision can be managed very, very badly. And who knows whether this is something that Joe Biden put a lot of thought into. It certainly doesn't look like it.
It does not reflect very well on him.
No.
You know, the sad thing, I mean, I really have tears in my eyes thinking about that. I was in Afghanistan.
Oh, yes?
And I met the women I met in Afghanistan and the women I met in Algeria are two of the bravest groups of women I've ever met. They suffer harassment, intimidation, beatings, and even death simply for doing what women the world over are able to do. Get up, go and do the work, go and do a job, pursue a career. They are forced not to do this. And if the Taliban returns to doing that, I just don't know what's going to happen. They say that the women will be allowed to work, and that certainly the education of women, girls, from primary to advanced level, tertiary level, will continue. But then they add the caveat under Sharia law. Yeah. And, you know, once you get into that, you don't know. So I fear the worst. The thing is getting them out, the people who helped in this so-called, quotes, war on terror, which was a George Bush phenomenon,
yeah,
following on 9/11. It was a reaction to 9/11. Mm. They couldn't go into Saudi Arabia, which had fueled most of this, being an ally. So they decided to go into Taliban. You know, the war
JJ, the 20-year war,
but most people don't even know what caused it, but it was simply that.
Well, it was also the fact that they were giving shelter and succor and protection, and openly so, to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Now, what I'm interested in, and we've got limited time here, but your real expertise come to bear in terms of al-Shabaab and Boko Haram, which we know are closely linked to organizations like al-Qaeda and ISIS. Do you think that this sort of thing and the lack of American power and authority in the Middle East will have spillovers into places where al-Shabaab and Boko Haram are very powerful and in control?
Well, you know, in those cases, both they have the Western powers, and in Mali, for example, in the Sahel, the Western groups are joining France to some extent, but countries like Germany haven't. They're not wanting to see deaths and any kind of disarray. But they've been shoring up countries with weak and unstable governments, and you have troop fatigue. You have casualties, you have dwindling support for such intervention at home, as I mentioned. And these Islamist groups very patiently and confidently wait, believing that they can outlast the enemy. And that is what has happened in Afghanistan. Mm. Now, they believe that they can do this in the Sahel. They believe they can do this in Somaliland. And that is a very, very dangerous for the people who want the so-called democracy to prevail, because when these groups come in, that democracy is defunct. So certainly France has no intention of withdrawing its troops, as America has done. But they want Barkhane, the operation in Mali, to decrease in size, to downsize to about half its size. It's currently 5,000. Mm-hmm. They have been promised or given support by some other Europeans, and not Germany, as I say. But it's an issue that, again, we have to learn from that. And any country that does get aid has to learn that it's a temporary thing, that they have to take it, use it.
Right.
You know, you saw that joke about it took $2 trillion in 20 years to try and down the Taliban, and
replace them with the
Toyota
Taliban.
Bucking with machine guns manned on the back to take it back again. And I mean, that is possible. And I don't think the Americans have an answer for that. And to hear Joe Biden trying to make cogent answers for that is quite sad.
But
because,
come on,
his own capabilities.
But come on, JJ, that was 5 days ago. That's what he said. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Sorry, JJ, before we lose you, I just wanted to ask you something. I was talking to somebody who worked for 25 years in sort of the same space as you. You've been a journalist in Africa, and she said something really interesting to me. It's unbelievably pragmatic, and you don't have to answer if you feel it compromises your journalistic integrity. But she said, the sort of permissiveness of information freely through cell phones, et cetera, was it's actually taken away a really important part of peacekeeping, is that there is a brutality to getting stability in areas, which if the citizenry sees it, becomes a problem. Like at the end of a barrel, unfortunately, sometimes to keep things stable in certain countries, it isn't just let's talk about it. There has to be a brutal element, and she's got an issue having worked in those spaces with just how that's being taken away. And unfortunately, she feels it needs to happen, and she doesn't know if we have other answers. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
So you're saying that?
I'm not saying. I'm telling you what she said.
No. You're saying that she's saying that you need brutality to tamp down a system on people, that at times it comes. You need the brutality to do it, and that social media has removed that. You know, I understand that sentiment. You got it in things like Korea and Japan, that you needed authoritarian governments to bring the people up. And so we have these two prosperous countries where they used authority, and Taiwan, another country, used totalitarian, authoritarian governments to bring them up. And that wouldn't have happened had it not been for that. And we take our own country, South Africa, we take Russia as examples of what didn't happen. But the reality is that we have here and in Russia situations that pertain, and we cannot impose on it an authoritarian regime. We cannot suddenly say, okay, we should do away with social media or any kind of exposing of brutality in the hope that a system can be imposed. I don't believe that in modern society that is possible. I understand the feeling or that this might have been one of the reasons that these systems were imposed, but in the long term those systems too fall.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, guys. I'd love to continue this conversation, but I'm interested also in hearing what JJ had to say about Afghanistan, and you know, we'll get round to this on the next episode of Africa Analysis. JJ Cornish, it's good to see you. Thank you as always, and have a good week.
My great pleasure. Next time we'll be talking about Nigeria. Remember your listeners' request.
Yes, no, sir. Nigeria is on the radar for next week. Excellent. JJ Cornish, and this is brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School, and we'll bring you another episode in about 2 weeks' time. So, Phumile Dwaba is here with us, Mbulelo Tinta, me, you, and that's kind of all we need in the next hour. We're also going to be joined in a little while by Douglas Rattray, whose famous family, they've been telling the story of KwaZulu-Natal and the story of the Zulu and the story of the Anglo-Boer War and the story of Blood River and the story of all of those amazing places and those incredible battles that add such color to the tapestry of South Africa, and stories which we need to tell our kids, because this is their history. They inherit this, and it's important for us to know what happened in the past. Otherwise, how the hell are we going to plot the future? And it's all really quite exciting, too. And the way that the Rattray family have done a great service to all of us by telling these stories over and over again is just something that gives me great pleasure. So he'll join us just now. If you've got questions for Mpumi, if you want to ask Mbulelo anything, you can let us know. Drop us a message on YouTube or 0797482090. The show is live. And if you're listening on podcast, you can always send me an email, gareth@cliffcentral.com. Stick around. More to come. Don't you go anywhere. It's a busy Tuesday morning.
CliffCentral.com.